Hey, what's up, Triniacs? Today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by our first ongoing sponsor, Health IQ.
Health IQ.
They are a life insurance company that offer active people like us Triniacs as much as a 25% savings on life insurance, which really just makes too much sense, right? Because with traditional life insurance, us healthy people are basically subsidizing the cost of insurance for the unhealthy people in that life insurance plan. And being a recovering investment advisor myself from a former life, that was actually legitimately always something that kind of irked me.
That ticked you off.
It ticked me off.
I throw
my suit on the ground and I hated it. If you want to learn more, go to healthiq.com/triathlon Taryn. That's where they put all the triathlete specific info for Health IQ, and it'll let Health IQ know how awesome us Triniacs and this podcast are. Today's guest on the podcast is Sarah Crowley, who's had probably one of the best all around full Ironman distance seasons of any female triathlete out there. She won 2 regional events at the Asia Pacific Ironman Championship, the European Ironman Championship in Frankfurt, huge, huge race, capped it off with a ITU long course win. And then she goes to Kona and finishes 3rd NTK. What do you say about Sarah Crowley and that big year?
She finished 3rd despite a crazy day at Kona. A very interesting, crazy day, which she gives us some insight into. Pretty fascinating.
Talks about her bike crash. Talks about running out of bananas.
You just blew the whole story.
Not the whole story, but part of it.
That's maybe my favorite part, running out of bananas. But yeah, she talks about that with us. And we get into, I guess, kind of off the course, so to speak, how she was able to balance 80 to 90 hour work weeks with being a pro triathlete, which is pretty fascinating and interesting.
She was a very highfalutin business person in corporate finance. She was a director for Deloitte in Australia, her home country. That's big business.
Yes.
Lots of ones and zeros. No. Lots of zeros after some ones, like tens and hundreds of millions of dollars she was working on.
Yes. You just made that very complicated. We talked to her about some advice that she would give to young business people, and particularly a young Sarah Crowley. If she could give advice to her younger self, what she would say. And
then we get into what her thoughts were basically leading up to Kona after that huge build, how she was coming into that with the mindset of how she would approach that after basically trying to peak 4 times throughout the year. And then finally, the questions that the media tried to bait her with in the week leading up to Kona.
Yep. Nasty media.
Not us. We're the good ones.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoy the interview with Sarah Crowley. We sure did enjoy talking with her, and thanks to Sarah.
She's delightful.
Very nice.
You'll see.
Enjoy. So we are here with Sarah Crowley. Sarah, thanks for being on the podcast with us.
No problem. It's a pleasure, Taryn. Always love to have a chat about triathlon and all things swim, bike, and run.
Although you were just playing in the snow, were you not?
Yeah. So, yes, I am obsessed with triathlon, but actually I'm on a break. So I'm having a bit of fun. Yeah. Seeing snow for the first proper time. So it was an experience for me today.
I saw on your YouTube channel that you played in the snow like last year.
Yeah, that was a little mediocre attempt at finding some snow, and that had actually melted the next day. It was just some leftover sleet. But today there's been a few dumps of snow at Park City. So we went up there and actually threw a few snowballs and did all the things. You guys are probably like, that's so lame, but for me it was amazing.
Well, that's the good part of snow. Just around here, when it's like 2 months from now and it's minus 30 and the snow is like, it wants
everywhere
and it wants to kill you, then it's less of an exciting time.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So yeah, let's chat here. You've had an awesome season. We were in Kona and seeing you cross the finish line, the battle that you had there, I want to get into all that. But in the last couple of weeks, I've done a fair bit of research getting ready for the interview here. And you've had a really interesting journey getting into triathlon quite a bit later. Like, it wasn't until, what was it, age 20, 21 that you did your first race?
Yeah, I guess I can technically say I've got an age group background, even though it was pretty early on. Yeah, I just got into it because in Australia we used to have this enduro series here where you could watch it on TV on the weekends. And, yeah, it was so exciting. And I remember watching a race live down at a beach near my house in my hometown of Adelaide, and I got quite excited about it. And I think I signed up for a club the next day. And so I was an age grouper to start with, but I progressed quite quickly. But I was sort of just by the time I was peaking, you know, kind of getting to the level where I needed to perhaps step it up, I was a fraction too old for under 23 system. So I had to make a big decision, and I ended up moving up to Queensland to train with a professional sort of a short course coach in an attempt to kind of make World Series, and which I eventually did. But in the meantime, I sort of qualified as a chartered accountant and did all these other things. So it's a long time ago now, but I guess it's still a very similar story to a lot of people that maybe go straight into long course nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. Like, how did you end up finding it, getting into short course there when you're probably going against people that had swam since they were 4 years old, and all of a sudden you're just getting into it and thrown into, like, I imagine you started with sprints and they're doing 8 minute 750 meter times, and and you're like, well, hey, I'm trying to learn the sport here.
Yeah, it was difficult at first. I mean, I did actually have a little bit of a swimming background, but I stopped for maybe my development years in swimming, so I kind of knew how to swim, but it was never good enough at the real higher senior levels of triathlon. So I could win World Cups and things off the back of, well, not World Cup, but Continental Cups off the back of a really strong run. But the swim was definitely something that, and in the end, it was probably the main reason why I went back to work for a few years and went back to a sort of a semi-pro type arrangement where I'd just go away on the weekends and race some regional kind of races. But definitely the swim was obviously a weak point. And I don't think I really met anyone until Cam that could actually rectify that with a sort of valid solutions other than just swimming more. So basically we went through a process of just getting myself as fit as possible and swim fit, but it really didn't have that much of an impact at that real extreme level where a minute matters. In, you know, you can't, a minute is fine at like Noosa, but a minute is like terrible. It's completely destructive in a, you know, World Series level. So, and then, you know, we've been, I eventually kind of decided I'd improved a fair bit towards the end of 15 just through consistency. Work wasn't as intense for a year or so, and I'd kind of got some training back under the belt after some significant, like, I work in corporate finance, so we had a few significant transactions while I went back to work and got a bit unfit. But towards 15, the end of 15, you know, things were a little bit quieter and I could manage it a bit better, the training, and I started to improve again. And I thought, oh, why not try long course? So, yeah, I stepped back from work again. And luckily at the same time, my current coach, who I had known in the past through some training that I'd done, was actually stepping back into a coaching role with Trisotto. He was a team manager or director of a cycling team, and he decided, well, that team kind of wound up and he needed to do something else, and it just tied in perfectly with me wanting to come back into triathlon. So the last 18 months or so, or 20 months, we've been focused real heavy on changing the swim stroke, which has had real dramatic impact on my racing.
Taking it back a little bit though, how would you, and we've heard conflicting stories about how much exposure young people have to triathlon and the sports in Australia when you're young and in school. Did you have much exposure to the sport at all, or is that a myth? We've heard somebody told us that you had to compete in a triathlon like in middle school years or something in Australia, and then we've heard from other people, no, that's not true. So what's the real story about that?
I guess it depends on your age. So I guess a history in sort of triathlon in Australia is we obviously flourished heavily in the early days prior to sort of being an Olympic sport. We were an early adopter with the US and a few other countries. So we had a really strong triathlon scene, but we never had it in schools. I think my brother may have done one at school, but I didn't know what it was. Like, I didn't really know other than what I'd seen with the televised stuff. It wasn't really easily accessible. I obviously, in Australia though, you do all sports. And I think that's a really important thing that perhaps is something maybe we go into early with the multi-sport nowadays with kids. But, you know, I found that we developed those sports individually first. Like at school, there's morning running, there's athletics, I'm sure it's the same in America, but in Australia, I guess we don't have the number of people. So kids tend to quadruple up in sport. So they're doing lots of sport. And yeah, I think, you know, you just sort of, my generation developed you know, develop via just sort of doing all the individual sports alone. And then when something came up and, you know, you could see a triathlon for real, it's like, wow, actually I can do all those three things and put it together. I guess nowadays we do have a development program, and there are probably maybe starting, say, 10 years ago or so, they started putting schools triathlons as a major kind of event, as all schools event where all the kids go to a place in the country once a year and compete, and then they get through into a system. So it has developed, I guess, with the advent of it becoming an Olympic sport, it's changed. It's become far more structured now.
Like a lot more specialized.
Yeah, I think so as well. There's even short course people versus like super short course people, which I found out about at the Bahamas, and versus sort of.
That looked awful, longer. By the way.
Oh, it was the most amazing experience, but it was very challenging for me.
Yeah, like last year and this, when they stacked up a whole bunch of long course athletes against short course, like, oh my God, why do you torture people that just got off of Kona like that?
Yeah, I think for us as well, we didn't have time to, I know personally, we didn't have time to do some serious threshold type work because the heart just isn't ready for it. So we could only manage by doing some speed, short, very short burst speed interval efforts. And, you know, that just doesn't cut it. Once you've gone past about 3 minutes, you're just hurting and your heart's just not ready for it. I never have experienced something where my body just doesn't respond to the, it sounds real corny, but like it just wasn't happening. And it was quite frustrating for me because I've always taken for granted that I can run fast or I can make it up with a quick run. But I think as well, the guys that have done Rotterdam had not only, like, obviously they do this for a job, they're a lot quicker, but they also had time to have a break and then build back into it. So as opposed to previous years, I think I got the feeling people take it a little bit more seriously in terms of their training specifically for it, which for me and Josh, my training partner, and a couple of other longer course people, it's pretty hard to match. So like a 3:40 pace will get you the third fastest run at Noosa, but 3:40s is so far off the mark when you've got 2Ks to run and those guys are running 3-minute Ks. So we're
talking about Island House here for anyone who wasn't following that. What's the hashtag? Pain in Paradise?
Paradise.
Yeah. Yes, and what's the format of the race? It's 3 days and the race structure is different than a normal triathlon, right?
Yeah, we barely make the distance of an Olympic over the whole event. It's actually
like
three
the entire
events.
3 days.
Yeah, it's three events over 2 days. So we double up on one day.
Oh, barf.
Yeah, the first session is really intense. It's a very short bike ride of only 7 kilometers, followed by a 2 kilometer run and then a 200 meter swim as an individual time trial basis. So you set off a minute apart. So that was difficult as well. If you hadn't done the course before, it was quite technical. It was actually wasn't really suited even to the powerful long course athletes because it was quite technical. So the shorter course athletes that get out of the saddle a lot more often and that were far more suited to the bike course, which really put me at a disadvantage because it's an area where I tend to find a strength these days. But yeah, that was quite an intense session. And the handicap from that meant it was cumulative time. So they took the time from that. And then in the afternoon, there was sort of an enduro type format race, which is a race where they split up a sprint try into smaller segments and the multiple triathlons kind of thing over the hour or so. So it started with a run and we started on a grid, depending on where you'd finished from the time trial. And then it was run 2 kilometers and then swims 3:75, bike 10, run 2, and swim 3:75, ride 10, run 1. So it totaled a sprint distance triathlon. And that event, then the time from that was then also cumulative for the third event, which was the second day where we had a sprint triathlon, which was also individual, but it went off your handicap from the previous day. So the fastest, Flora, I think, started first, and then it sort of flowed back through to everyone else.
Oh, this just sounds awful. Did you have any moments like we saw with Sebastian Keenley where like he was running up the beach and like almost unconscious after crossing the finish line?
Yeah, I felt like I was the only girl that was so wrecked that I was on my haunches after the first one. I feel like it was just such a shock to my body to be to sustain the high intensity effort it was only 20 minutes, but it's just not something I was able to train for. So it was such a shock. So yeah, I personally was like that. And I feel maybe by the end everyone was definitely hurting and things did change throughout the event, not a huge amount, but, you know, say perhaps the second enduro saw Ellie Salthouse come through pretty well. I think that sort of suited her a little bit better because she could, you know, probably the longer course athletes, that would have been that second event would have probably been our better one of the three for sure.
How did Terenzo Bazzone end up doing so well?
Yeah, I don't know.
Bizarre. Like him and Ben Canute. Like Ben is, he's got the history with ITU kind of recently, but Terenzo's been out of it for 6 years.
Where did he finish?
Second, right?
Yeah, they had a sprint finish. It was good actually. We'd just finished our event and had gotten changed and we're coming back to support when we saw them finish. And it was literally sort of a pretty much a chest to the finish line type dive almost that got Ben the win. But yeah, I think Terenzo is really talented. Hey, like I think he's underestimated a little bit. He always does perform really well at the halves. So he does have the speed. And I know he was focused pretty heavily on this race. But like I said, I mean, for me from Kona, it just drained so much. But I had a cumulative, I guess, fatigue from doing three or four other big events during the year. So, I mean, maybe whereas Terenzo kind of had Kona and then same with, say, a Rachel Joyce or whatnot, they kind of just had Kona. Oh, no, Rachel raced a fair bit, but some of the others that did the longer stuff didn't quite have as many races. So maybe Terenzo wasn't as tired from that. But he's got a massive schedule. I mean, he's racing Bahrain this weekend. He's signed up for Ironman WA, Taupo. And I think I remember last year he may have back-to-back doing WA and Taupo. So, yeah, it's his time of year. I think he just likes this end of the season part. So
he's just getting started now.
He's just getting started, yeah.
So it's been how long since you did ITU racing? I know that you got into it a fair bit when you first started doing more pro racing in 08, 09, but is that basically the last time that you started, you were doing short course?
Yeah, that's the extent of it. I mean, we do often drop in a few races here and there. See, for instance, earlier in the year, I raced in New Caledonia and had a fantastic run.
How long was that course?
That was Olympic distance. So for me, that's a sort of a shorter race. But yeah, like I think, you know, the end of the season is just such a different beast, you know, and it's not just physically, it's mentally. And I honestly went into it thinking that I'd be 100% and fine. But, you know, when the body doesn't do what you're expecting, it's a bit of a shock. It's, it's really, really tricky. So yeah, I'm glad to be on a break now though. I'm really just enjoying myself and I'm looking forward to the rebuild for next year.
Do you get itchy and antsy to do long endurance stuff when you're on your break, or are you just happy to kind of kick back and stay out of your sneakers and just kind of relax? Because I know Taryn gets so antsy if he can't work out, but he's not putting in the volume you are.
Yeah, I feel like I might be like that next week, but for the moment I'm really, really enjoying not really doing much, you know. And when I say that, I still go for, we went walking yesterday for quite a while, just looking around at things. And I went for a little swim today, just for a paddle, but it's, you know, it's not.
For some context, what is a little swim for you now?
Yeah, exactly.
Just like 4,000 meters?
2,000 yards or something, I think. Yeah.
Oh,
geez. A lot of kicking and
it's like a warm up for you.
Yeah. I think, the biggest learning I got from Island House, which I think is great, is that, you know, I've really adapted to the long course. I enjoy the long course training. I enjoy racing longer. I did have thoughts in my mind that I could return and do some shorter stuff after performing pretty well at a few Olympic distance races during the year. But, you know, I'm quite satisfied that I'm suited to doing the longer stuff. And now I can, you know, not kind of cut my losses and sort of put some eggs in all different baskets. I can go full gas for the long stuff. So it's really exciting for next year, I think. I can focus a bit stronger. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it, but it's good to also just sort of get away from it all in these few weeks. But there's definitely areas where we can improve in the longer stuff going into next year.
You know, that's interesting. And I think there's a lot of beginner triathletes that follow Taryn and follow our podcast. And I think that's a very interesting and valuable piece of information to hear, the fact that you've realized, okay, the long course is where I need to be. And that's good for you. And you can not necessarily drop down to the shorter courses just because you're fit enough to do the long course doesn't mean you can just go into a sprint and win it or kill it or whatever. But just that, I really like that piece of info that you've figured out where you are best at. Now you can put all your eggs in that basket. Because I think a lot of beginner triathletes think that there is only working up and you have to get to the Ironman level or you're not a triathlete or there's nothing else. But they might stop at Olympic and go, okay, this is my distance. This works for me. This works for my body. Eggs in this basket. Like I think that's really neat to hear someone like you say that and that process of going through it and figuring it out.
Yeah, I actually think it's important as well. I mean, for me, I didn't do a triathlon for 10 years of doing triathlon, an Ironman, sorry, for 10 years of doing triathlon. And it took some time before I decided that I was really willing and able to do it. And I think that from what I've seen amongst people that I train with, like I do train with age group people. And like, I mean, I was basically training as an age grouper myself for quite some time. And one thing I learned to appreciate is the extra stresses on your life. Like you know, you're doing it's not just triathlon, you're working, you've got families, and it's very stressful. And I think the people that I've seen really successfully stay in the sport for a long period of time, like using it as an actual method to stay fit and healthy, as opposed to being obsessed with triathlon as a, you know, performance sport, those people that seem to stay in it for longer do just appreciate the fact that they get to socialize, they appreciate just training, they enjoy just doing, say, a shorter distance race here and there. They don't put any pressure on themselves to perform, and they come back year after year, and they then might go through a period of a few years where they want to do a longer race or whatever, but they seem to just find that there's a happy balance of, you know, not going too intense to try and just do an Ironman, build through the levels, and then they just get burnt out. So yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with just finding a distance that you completely enjoy and you can manage with what you've got in your life to do well enough that you feel that you get some self-achievement out of it. You know, that's really what it's all about. There's things that even Island House, I walked away not feeling depressed with a bad result. Like there were things there that I could walk away with and say, well, that was good that I was able to do this or that. And same with like the Noosa Triathlon a few weeks before. And, you know, you're always learning. It's not always just about kind of getting faster or getting to the next level. It's got to be about what you can fulfill for yourself.
Hey triathletes, slight pause here in the interview. We are healthy people who take care of ourselves. We eat right. So how does it feel knowing that you are paying basically the same for life insurance as a lot of the unhealthy people out there? Sucks, right? Well, that's why when Health IQ reached out to me to talk about supporting this podcast, being a former investment advisor, once I heard their story, I was so in for sharing it with you, because Health IQ is an insurance company that provides as much as a 25% savings to triathletes, runners, swimmers, cyclists, vegans, etc. If you live a healthy lifestyle, odds are really good that they can get you savings on your life insurance. Health IQ actually just recently announced that they raised over $35 million in venture capital funding from Andreessen Horowitz. And these guys are big money hustlers in Silicon Valley. So they're making a lot of waves in just a few short years that they've been around. I like it. They're shaking it up, changing things, making it different. Now, if you want to learn more, go to the Trainiac's unique info page at healthiq.com/triathlon Taryn. Using that URL will get you to the triathlete specific info for Health IQ, and it'll help us out because it'll let Health IQ know that we and the Trainiac community is so awesome. Back to the interview. Yeah, that's interesting. We've got one guy in our training group that in every discipline, he's faster than I am, but he also owns a business that just crushes his summer because he owns a pool company. So he's super fit in the winter. And in the run, he's like a minute faster than me on 5,000 meters. In a time trial, he's probably 2 minutes faster over 40K. In a swim, he's about 15 seconds faster in a 400 meter pool. But go into an Olympic distance or a half Ironman race, and I'm beating him by like 5 minutes and 15 minutes just because he can't put in the volume. Like he's doing an 8-hour training week, and he's had to realize over the last, I think he tried 2 half Ironmans and he couldn't crack 5 hours, and we were expecting him to do like a 4:40, and he just realized all I can do is sprint. It's all that life gives me.
Yeah. If, you know, until circumstances change, and that's, my coach is really acutely aware of that stuff. I see my training change depending on little things that we might have to do if there's travel or whatnot. You know, I mean, for me, it's not as obviously without having to go to a desk job anymore, it's a bit easier, but he definitely adjusts things for life stress. It does massively impact your ability, and you can push through it. Like, who cares if you wanted to do your second swim in a day or whatever, but if you had to drive somewhere and then try and fit it in, it does put you under a lot more stress. So yeah, those things do add up. And I think, you know, in the long run, you just want to stay in the sport. If you don't stay in the sport, it's you know, that's the worst outcome. So, you know, it's interesting, but I think the most important thing, yeah, for age groupers is to still be enjoying it. And if you're stressing yourself out, trying to do more and more and more at the expense of maybe, you know, sleep and work performance at work and other things, and it's, you know, eventually something's got to give.
And even your longevity in the sport. Like, you can go and smash yourself to do the longest distance race that you can, but it might be the last race that you ever do.
Exactly. You do that a lot.
And I mean, Ironman has done such a brilliant job of marketing the longest distance in the sport, right? That people, a lot of, especially beginners, think, again, like I said, it isn't, you're not a triathlete if you don't do Ironman, where they could have a very happy and fulfilling career doing sprints. But so many, especially new people to the sport, because this huge marketing machine is just makes it look so glamorous and amazing that you just, I think a lot of people think they're not accomplishing something if they only, I say in quotations, do a sprint. But I mean, a sprint would be my Ironman, that's for sure.
It's interesting because in the professional world, there's this, we call it sort of blue carpet syndrome, where the people doing this, the fast stuff, don't want to do Ironman because of stigma that maybe goes with the, you know, it's not an Olympic stream sport. So it's almost the opposite for the professionals. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Really, really.
That like is the, so interesting.
Like the ITU athletes. Well, yeah, I guess if it was Kona or nothing, you'd see so many of the ITU, like you'd see every ITU athlete graduating out and coming into long course.
Yeah, but they I mean, the pedigree of being, you know, coming through the elite system of the Olympic stream is kind of very, sort of, I guess it's a reputation people want to maintain. And it's kind of, even myself, I was like, oh, really, long course? But, you know, in the end of the day, it's actually far more lucrative in terms of prize money and support and everything else. So it's almost the opposite to the age group kind of mentality of going longer. Yeah.
But it's just, like you said, you figured out where your body is best, what works best for you, what you're best suited to. It happens to be the longer course stuff. People just need to find that where their body is best, I think, is the, you know, especially for the age groupers.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Something that you said there was fitting it into life, and we haven't touched on it at all, but you used to be like big, serious money hustler in Deloitte, like director. Yeah. What did you do? You referred to it once as director of good times, or is that now?
Yeah. That's what I'm now.
I want that job, by the way, like if they're taking openings in Canada.
When I go back, that's what I want to do, just be graduate recruitment fun times.
What was the role? You're at what do they call it in Australia, CA or CPA?
Yeah, CA. So, yeah, chartered accountant. So, basically, I was a chartered accountant before I went off work for the first time to move to Queensland to train with the Queensland Academy of Sport for the short course stuff. I'd spent the first few years even training and working at the same time and got my qualification then. But then, when I got back to work, I mean, so I've always in the corporate finance field, which, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the age group guys listening probably are fully aware of kind of what that means, but it's like,
that's an intense job. That
it is. Yeah.
What were you doing 80, 90 hour weeks?
Yeah, it was pretty horrible. So, I mean, Deloitte's amazing, but they've been so supportive. I've always been there. So all the whole way, but basically, yeah, I'd run transaction services jobs for large mergers and acquisitions. So I do the due diligence component. And yeah, it was pretty stressful. Like we'd be doing some pretty major transactions. Some of the stuff we worked on was with GE and Caterpillar, big global $1 billion transactions.
You'd be working with the investment bankers that would say pitch a GE or a Caterpillar that they should buy XYZ company for $100 million, and you would come in and work with them on the due diligence of, is it worth $100 million and how do you structure it?
Exactly. So yeah, we would, we would.
That? I got that right in TK.
Well, okay. Spot on, right?
A little secret is Taryn may have been in finance as well before he became triathlon Taryn, just as an aside.
Yeah, right.
It's true. I had a lot of letters in behind my name for a lot of years.
Yeah. I got letters too. They're gone now. No.
Yeah, same. As soon as I stopped paying my dues, they sent me letters like 3 months later. Like, you are no longer a CFP. Like, oh, well.
Like that work meant nothing, but anyway. Yeah. Well, it's good you've seen the bright side of life.
Yeah. When you were doing that, like now you live such a different life that people in finance, a lot of them dream of, like traveling the world and doing triathlon. When you were kind of 1 foot in finance and 1 foot in triathlon, did you feel like the finance wasn't quite what you wanted to do and you were drawn to the triathlon?
Well, I did it. I mean, I still enjoy what I do, like what I did. Like I really do. I'm passionate about it. I felt maybe though perhaps I needed something slightly different to do. Like I felt like perhaps I was bottomed out with, I kind of knew how to do it all. It was just became a process, which I found became a bit mundane after a while. I've got quite an active mind and I like to kind of explore different things. So, you know, maybe had I moved into say an advisory kind of role, which involves like actually arranging the transactions, I think I would have probably been, you know, had a second wind of effort, but definitely while I was started to perform better, it became more and more difficult to go into the partner's office and ask for time off to travel to South Korea for a race and have extra days here and there. And it just became difficult. And I felt that I wasn't giving enough to the sport. I did have more and that I wasn't achieving what I could be capable of. And it became very, very frustrating. I didn't want to be the person that could sit there and just go, oh, I could have done this, but I just didn't. I could just take a risk and just give it a go. So, yeah. Oh. It was a bit of a tug of war.
And eventually, what was the linchpin that said to you finally, like, you know what, if I'm going to try to make it in triathlon, I've got to make this leap out of finance?
Well, I guess there were a few factors. I mean, my husband was studying at the time, like he was finishing a law degree. So he was still working, but it was, I needed to kind of work while he was doing that. So there was a reason sort of personally, financially that I needed to stay in the office. And triathlon, if you don't do great, isn't amazingly lucrative for professionals. Like it's very difficult to start with, definitely. And so I never expected to kind of be able to make a living from it. So I had to sort that out first. And then I guess there came a point where I raced 3 races in a row in 15. I did, I think, I raced Garay and I won 70.3 in Korea. And then 2 weeks later, I raced the World Duathlon Championship and I had a bad race. And then I raced 2 weeks after that. I did a Malaysian Ironman and it was just so messed up. Like, I walked away going, what am I even doing? Like, these are all different races. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have anyone guiding me. But then I did okay enough at all of them to think, well, surely if I put in more effort into, you know, training and preparing appropriately for the right distance that, you know, I would go better. And I got so sick of just getting fourth all the time. It was like ridiculous. So yeah, I think it just came to a point where it was either now or never. It was like, well, if I don't do it now, it's just going to pass me by the opportunity. And so, yeah, I just decided, pretty much went through a process of coach selection after that. And I felt like there was a few factors that I needed. I needed someone nearby. I needed that day-to-day contact because I'd come from a system coming from the, you know, Australian sports system. I was used to the daily training environment. I needed that. Like I didn't want online. I needed, you know, the experience, someone with a lot of long course experience Cam himself did actually have himself personally as an athlete, but also he had coached a couple of people throughout the years where he was a director of a cycling team. And I saw their performances were really good for the athlete. And his connection to Brett was really good because obviously
Brett Sutton, Daniela Reef's coach.
Yeah, yeah. So he's had, you know, Chrissy Wellington and, you know, all this success that they've had. And I had other coaches that I thought were equally really good, but there was just something magic that I felt with Cam that I could communicate with him really, really well. And, you know, the knowledge from Brett that was clear right from first interviewing him that there was something different that I didn't know. Like I'd obviously come through a triathlon, you know, training system where, you know, I thought I knew a lot of stuff. We'd been through the Australian Institute of Sport And so I thought, I got this. It's just more of that. But, you know, I learned that there's actually a lot more to the long course, and it's a different approach, and I didn't realize. And that was really evident as opposed to the other couple of coaches that I spoke to. So yeah, I've made that decision, and we worked through it for the first few months of 16 where I was still working. But I put in my notice for a leave of absence. I'm technically still employed by Deloitte at the moment, but I'm on a leave of absence from the firm.
So what now in triathlon do you still make pivot tables about? Because I know that I can't get away from them.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, I saw.
I was saying this to Kim yesterday, and she's like, what's a pivot table? She'll know.
And you do.
2 days before the Hawaiian Ironman, I was helping a friend of mine who got stuck with a formula. I was so excited to be able to help.
What is a pivot table?
You don't want to know. Well, no, like nobody listening wants to know unless they're in finance.
Yeah. It's just like a way of cutting up a spreadsheet into different, you can, you know, reorganize the data in an effective way, I guess.
You can set it up in a way that you punch in one thing and a whole bunch of other things change and you're like, how did it change? And yeah.
Okay, that's enough. Thanks. Yeah, let's move on.
That's as simple as I can make it.
Yeah, I don't really run any pivot tables at the moment, but I do use some formulas on a few things. Yeah, I do. I'm very particular about processes and checklists and things. Like I'm really particular about recording things and remembering stuff and doing things with lists and everything. So I operate a little bit like I'm at work in that regard.
So
definitely.
Maybe all triathletes need like a short course in finance before they really get into the sport if they want to succeed. This is what they need.
Maybe there's a lot of athletes, Sarah Pimpiano. Yeah, there's, you know, I think Rachel Joyce, like there's a lot of people out there that have a background in corporate.
I'll speak of it less highly than you do. Maybe that is motivation to be really good at triathlon so they don't have to go back. Could be that.
Yeah, he left running screaming from finance, whereas it sounds like you did not. So,
yeah, take these letters.
Have them. I don't want them.
I do appreciate every single day that I have where I'm doing what I'm doing. It's such a privilege, like, to be able to do what I do and experience the things I do. It's like a life journey that I not everyone gets to do it. So it is a privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a magical place. Like we went to Kona this year. And the last time we went was 2013 when I was right in the thick of growing my investment practice. And it was wild to be at Kona. And that was where we were like as our job. Like we were there. And
this year, you mean?
This year in 2013, it was something that we did off to the side. And I tell you, when like you and Daniela and Patrick Lange and Lionel were all crossing the line, I was probably the only camera person up in behind the finish line that had tears in my eyes because everyone else out there is a pro and they're like, oh yeah, this is my third event this month. And I had tears in my eyes because I'm like, oh my God, I 4 years ago I was here and it was this thing I did off to the side as a spectator. And now this is life. And yeah, we get to experience this. I'm maybe on the other side of the barrier than you are, but
it's a very unique thing to be doing. It is lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about Kona. You had an awesome, awesome year. You won two regional championships, won the ITU long course, and then you go to Kona. And to be perfectly honest with you, in the lead up, I did my video on who I thought the favorites were and you were in there. And I had this big question of going like, you know, she's done so much distance this year. And can she pull it out for what would this be? That was the fourth long course race that you did of the year? Like fourth long course A race?
Yeah, in 6 months almost.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Like something.
I think, it was unreal. I think, you know, we started, I was in real good shape for Cairns. Like we'd really spent, I didn't go down the route of going doing an early Ironman. Like we just went and did training. I did a few halves at the start of the year. Did some really big blocks to get the swim sorted, and then I got real run fit. We did some real big running, and my talent is running, so I feel. And so, I just accelerated from that, and I came into Cairns, and I was in great form. And, you know, I like to be grey man. I keep it now. It's like I just want to do my best, and whatever result is the result. And so I knew I could win the race, but you're going to go around and win this race. Like, you just go there and do your best. And I think I walked away going, well, that was good, but I didn't go to the well in the last 10Ks of the run. And I think this was the trick for the whole year. And that same thing happened again when we went to Frankfurt. I caught Lucy, and then I could just back it off a little bit in the back end of the run.
Right, because you caught her at Frankfurt at about 5K?
It was a bit longer, actually. Lucy ran really well. Like, I think maybe it was 20. It was probably halfway, at least 1.5 laps of the course. So, yeah, it was a fairly fair way in. But, you know, once again, after I passed her, I didn't need to drop, you know, the speed or anything. Like, it was done. So, once again, you know, I had those two were quite good. I questioned whether I'd do Frankfurt very well, but we did a little mental trick where we kind of just went to St. Moritz, trained, and I didn't get to the race until the Thursday before. We drove from St. Moritz to Frankfurt and arrived, and I was like, oh, this is actually quite a bit of a big deal, eh?
It's a huge race, yeah.
Huge race, and I hadn't appreciated that, and I think it was kind of a trick for me because, you know, that way I didn't have to focus on it. Like, it wasn't really a big thing in my head. So I turned up and I was very laid back and ready to go, and it was good. Like, I controlled my race really well and didn't sort of buy into the size of the event. But then equally, the event, I drew energy from the crowds and the event, and that helped me with backing up. And then after that, I was excited because I was heading to Park City, which is here, and, you know, get training with my friends and experience the altitude. And I know I get good adaption. We did it the year before. I spent a lot of money last year traveling and reinvesting all my winnings into travel and testing of, like, how I perform, you know, back-to-back races or things. Like, last year we did 3 back-to-back halves a week apart, and I also traveled to altitude. So I knew how I'd respond. And so we just came here and got the business done. I one of my mates from Brisbane came over. The coach came eventually, like, he went home after St. Moritz, but then he came over as well. So we created a really nice environment where we could train. We don't have a lot of outside influences. There's not a heap of triathletes here, so we just got the work done. And then, yeah, same again, dropped into Penticton quite late and, you know, got the benefit of being at high altitude. And so I had a phenomenal run at that event. And then we went home and it was nice back home, and it was quite comfortable. I had a good 5 weeks in, you know, my home environment, which kind of, you know, psychologically helped me get through to the Kona. So I think, you know, if Kona was a little bit longer, I probably would have struggled a bit more, but, you know, the gaps were just perfect. But, yeah, afterwards it's been a little bit more difficult now, but I guess it doesn't matter. We've got plenty of time for next year now, so you have a nice long.
Let's talk about the race specifically. Like, the moment that I want to pick up on in Kona was the crash. So you crashed it coming down out of Javi, right? Right before Kauai. Is that kind of around, what, 100K?
It was before Kauai. It was at 70Ks. It was probably the last A station before you get to the T intersection on the Queen K. So it was sort of early. So what had happened was I took a drink, and it's kind of an uphill cutout section. And I took a drink, and then I thought about a second drink, and Danny didn't take the bottle. I was like, oh, well, I'll grab it.
Because your race plan was to follow Danny and shadow her as long as you could, right?
Basically, like, you know, you've seen her race the last 2 years, and the bike is where it happens for her. And, you know, I felt that with my run, if I could hold in there as long as possible, then that's my best chance, after especially having such a good swim. So, you know, I was just doing my thing and making sure I was trying to get everything right with the fluids and everything else. And I just made a really dumb decision. And we talked about it before the race with the coach. It's like, you know, you can do all this training and everything can be perfect, and you can have a few things go wrong, but you can have a one knockout punch, and you've got to watch out for that. Like, you don't get on the feet in the swim, or something happens on the bike and that's it. It's done. It doesn't matter what you've done in training. It doesn't matter about the small aerodynamic gains from, you know, different helmets and shoes and all the small things. Like, you know, that's it. You're done. And what happened? I took the bottle and I was drinking out of it, and we passed through the cutout, and a strong gust blew from the right onto my wheel, and I had one hand on the base bar, and it sort of blew my wheel a bit. And it wasn't actually that did it. It was when the wind gust ended, I'd been applying pressure to my bars, and my bars just slipped out from underneath me. They flipped over, and The next minute, there's me on the ground and in a lot of shock because you just don't expect that to happen. I mean, luckily it was a kind of an uphill section, so it wasn't going terribly fast. But I was lucky Annabelle came past and shouted at me. I trained with Annabelle Luxford a little bit. She swims with us at times in Brisbane, and she's just said to get up. And I think it was the little thing that maybe if Annabelle hadn't have called that, I would have maybe doubted it. But it was like enough to sort of snap me out of it, and I got straight back on the bike. But I did burn the match that I needed, I think, at the end of the bike, getting back on the bike and accelerating to get back up, you know, into the position where I was prior to falling over.
Right, so, because you got right up to Danny very shortly.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, was there a second there where you thought your race was over? Did your brain go there, or were you still just too disoriented as to what was going on?
Well, I think the first thing is, okay, I'm on the ground. This is odd. What's going on?
And
that
bad.
Actually went through my head. And it's like, wait a minute, this is the Hawaiian Ironman, and you just got out the front of the swim. This is the best opportunity you've had in your whole life. What are you doing? What's just happened? And then Annabelle shouted, and I'm like, yep, no choice, go. And that was it. And, you know, then I guess you assess your body first and then the bike and see if there's any long-term issues with the bike.
And was there anything?
Not particularly, no. I just had a bit of a rub off of one of my bar. The bar tape came a little bit of a raise on that, but the rest was fine.
Really?
My body.
You escaped lucky then, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was very lucky, yeah.
Yeah, like coming across the finish line, I had no idea that you crashed, and it wasn't until I think a day or two after that I heard that you crashed. What the?
When
did this happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, like I had to just really go once I got back on. It was, if I don't get going and just sort of get back into the rhythm of this race and sort of ignore what just happened, then I'm going to be very much passed by a lot of people very quickly. Like if you kind of just don't get that intensity back in. So the only option was to get back into the actual race and just get back on the bike and get back up into, the position that I was in and sort of, yeah, but I mean, obviously there was a detriment to my race because, you know, you can never quantify what that did. But I think I haven't felt in all the races this year, I've gotten off the bike and had to control my run. Whereas this felt like one of my first Ironmans I'd ever done. And I honestly felt like I was in a lot of trouble in those first couple of kilometers in the run. It wasn't a great place, but I just bear with it. I knew the training had been done and it was there. I just had to be patient.
So you get back on the bike, you get up to Danny really quick. There's that graph that I can't remember the guy's name from Training Peaks that he did where he mapped out everyone's race and your line is like right overlapping Danny's. And then at kilometer 40, hers peaks up and her speed picks up and you go with her for 10K or so. What was going through your head when she's like time trialing coming into T2?
Yeah, that's where I'm like, oh, damn, that crash. Now I've got nothing. no, I was actually really hungry. I overcompensated my eating because of the accident. I actually went into this don't forget to eat mode and I actually ate all my food really early. And yeah. It was weird, but by the end of the ride, I was actually hungry because I needed more food. And there were things that maybe in this race, in other races, there's quite a few bananas out on course. There wasn't as many bananas, and I do take a lot of bananas just to fill myself up. And, I feel like maybe I was missing a few calories. So when Danny did that, I mean, I was fully expecting that. I knew that's how she'd race it. She was in a position where she was stuck. She either caught up, let Lucy go, and risked not catching Lucy on the run or dragged me, a runner, up to Lucy. And so she had to play the back end of the bike. And I just felt like perhaps maybe, I just needed a little bit more food. And then it got to a point where we went through an aid station and I did maybe another thing that seems like such a trivial thing and shouldn't have made it was a mistake, but it was something that, you know, normally it wouldn't have mattered, but because of how fast she was riding, it did. And that was, I stuffed around trying to get a food out of a package that was in my back pocket that wasn't in my bento box. It was my backup food. And, you know, by the time I was looking at it while I was unpackaging it, and all of a sudden she's 50, 100 meters up the road because I wasn't concentrating on the race. And so I didn't react to her move because she went pretty hard through that first bit, but it wasn't that bad. Like it was fast. We went quick on the way back, but I'd trained along there and I was aware of that being it can be a quick section, just before the windy bit at the end. And so, yeah, that was fine. But I think it was just more that I wasn't being attentive enough at the last aid station. And then just like that. And then when you start to question yourself, you're sort of alone. And it was hot. I could feel the cut on my leg. Started to feel hungry. And, yeah, it was a pretty different experience for me compared to the previous races where I'd really back-ended my ride. I was left a little bit lonely out there in the last bit.
If you had managed to stay with her coming into T2, do you think you could have ran with her the entire way?
I think if I'd stayed with her into T2, I would have eaten enough and I feel like maybe I would have felt better. So I don't know if I could have or not. I feel like I would have been able to pass Lucy quite easily. I feel like maybe with Lucy in the run, I didn't go early enough. I did actually come good eventually on the run after we got up onto the Queen K. I felt fine and I was kind of just being conservative again. And maybe I could have gone a bit earlier because also as well, like having had the accident in transition, I was in there for an extra minute sorting myself out. I was almost in tears. I was so confused about how that had happened and somewhat like you're in this weird state of being sort of, I don't know, like surprised that you're able to ride the way through but confused as to whether you can keep going. And, yeah, so I kind of, despite that, I was still working as quickly as I could to get ready to run, but I was standing there just staring at my things for a little bit, which was a bit strange. So I definitely got bedazzled by the accident. So I don't know. I couldn't say. Like, I mean, it is what it is. It's happened now. So,
but pretty remarkable, though, then to finish where you did, considering all that you're just revealing here and the crash. I mean, I think that would have put a lot of people right completely off their race. And while it did affect you to some degree, you still had a pretty great finish.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've spoken to my coach about this and I feel like I often run through like possible scenarios a lot in a race. Like I'm very strategic about what I do when and try and work out what the outcomes of different things would be. And I feel like maybe in the race I probably didn't empty the bucket enough and I feel like maybe I held back enough that I was 100% always going to get third. Like there was, you know, I didn't take any risks to jeopardize that happening after I had that crash. And I was fully confident that that was always going to happen. I was never concerned about Heather at all. Like not once was I concerned about being with Heather.
When did you come together on the run?
In the energy lab.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hate to ask these questions, but like down at the finish line, it was all Lionel and Patrick and Sebastian and Cameron Wirth, and that was all they talked about. And then they all finished and like, oh, we still have a race left. I'm like, yeah, guys, yeah. I kind of wanted updates here for the last hour.
Yeah, that's the problem with, I guess, the racing all on the same day and perhaps not having quite as much coverage for the women's is a bit of a shame. But like, I mean, it is what it is. I guess we were out there racing, but I honestly felt like maybe I didn't take, if I was fine off the bike, I would have been going for Lucy and Danny for sure. And I just lost that, the mongrel and the killer instinct. And I played a more conservative and strategic game in order to get on the podium. So, yeah, there's more to come. And that's what's exciting. Like, you know, really, it is. So right. I walked away and I was like, I've got to go again.
Right. You can like taste if that's what you can do with a crash and with messing up the nutrition. Yeah. That it's like when Pete Jacobs finished on the podium and he started thinking about next year. He's like, I'm going to win this.
Yeah, it's really promising. And also to have a build up where I don't have to race as much and I can kind of come into it in the form I was at for Cairns. I feel like I was in better form for Cairns. Oh, I mean, I'm a more experienced racer by Kona, but in terms of running form was much better in Cairns. Mm. Yeah, I ran fast. I feel like I was in much fitter form for Cairns.
You said going into the race that your goal was just to put out the race plan that your coach Cam Watt laid out for you. How close, let's take the bike and running out of bananas out of it. How close did you get to executing that plan?
Yeah, really close. So really, I had to adjust it, obviously, because of, and that is part of the plan, is to adjust and be smart enough to adjust. So yeah, executed the swim 110%. The bike, yeah, other than the nutrition, it was pretty close. And then the run, well, we had to adjust. So it was the best outcome I could have got for where I was at. So, yeah, we're really pleased in terms of being able to that's, you know, and then that's why you walk away and you feel fantastic. It doesn't matter. You know, you did what you had to do. You did everything you could. Yeah. So I think it's now it's just progressing. I know that, you know, if that accident didn't happen, things might have been a bit different. But, yeah, it's good signs for next year.
But it doesn't.
I know that the run isn't so, like, we're not, I'm not running as quick as I'm running in training yet. It's like we've gotten to this level that's really good, but I haven't been able to execute that in a race. But we haven't really done a race where I've been able to empty the bucket completely and go in intentionally to run really fast. So that's exciting as well for next year.
It sounds like, though, that, you know, you're talking very matter-of-factly about had that crash not happened, et cetera. It doesn't sound like you're kind of kicking yourself, though, going, ah, I can't, like, I wish I could take that back because of what could have been. You seem pretty okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't change it, so there's no point in dwelling on it. Right. It's like, thing that, you know, I mean, it happened. So, yeah.
But a lot of people, I think, could get that feeling of, oh, like, I could have had it. It was stolen away from me by fate, by wind, whatever. And it's, I think it's hard to just say, well, it happened. That's the past. We'll just build on it. A lot of people would let that kind of bother them, I think.
Yeah, you sound pumped.
Yeah. I can see that. It's like, I mean, I guess you have good days and bad days. And, you know, when things happen that are really good, I don't know how many people are thankful either of the things going their way, you know, like, you sort of go and expect things to all go your way all the time. So, yeah, I don't know. I've always been a real process-driven person. I guess that happened. Now what do I do? What do we have to do to get the next best thing that we can get and just go through the process? So I think some of those skills from work help with my mental preparation and preparedness and things in races for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, bike crashes, the minute stress compared to working on a $100 million deal that has to be done in 12 hours and it's 10 p.m.
Someone's ringing you up for the final report and the partner's not there to sign it and you've got an ethical dilemma of delivering the report to a bank in London versus like going through due process and getting hassled by people that don't understand that you could lose your license if you just give it to them or whatnot, like, or just ethical things of people trying to ring you and force you to change numbers or something. Like, it's nothing compared to that. So,
yeah. You ran out of bananas. You're not dealing with 10 zeros.
Yeah. And it's funny. And I'll just digress a little bit on that, but equally at work, I used those skills when I was working as well to take the pressure off at work. So perhaps when I was under a lot of pressure in front of people doing a talk or something like that and presenting a document or whatever, you know, you could draw back from like, well, standing on the start line for the London test event is a little bit more stressful than standing in front of, you know, 10 people in a room trying to pitch a document. So that, you know, it works both ways. It's quite good.
I never thought about that. One question that I've got is like, what happens after such a great year to a pro? Like, what do sponsors just start calling you off the hook and like strange men showing up with buckets of money and wanting you to wear their gear? And like, this is a banner year for anyone, never mind somebody that's going from like literally just really committing seriously to long course 20 months ago. Like, this is a huge change. What happens now with that?
Yeah, I think, there are strange men turning up, but they're to do drug testing. So we get tested a lot. That's probably one thing that I have to factor in, like my preparedness for like making sure that all my whereabouts is filled out and it's accurate, because that's like something that's really changed. And, you know, you have to actually be, I just won't fill it out, because you can actually get in a lot of trouble for not being available. And so that's something that's very different. I mean, I'd always been tested in the past, but like to have regular out of competition testing is something that you really need to be kind of on the ball with to make sure that, you know, you're not going to get in trouble and do things wrong and, you know, not be available. So like just making sure all that stuff is right is like a whole new thing for me, I guess. That's one thing. And then I guess with the sponsorship, I guess it's kind of like, well, the door got slippery. Before it was like hard to talk to people, and now they're more than willing to give you things to try and you can pick the best stuff. I was lucky to put myself in a scenario of kind of not fully committing to a lot of my product sponsors before the race. And so now I've got the opportunity to pick from the best products that are best for me. And that's why we're going to Frankfurt soon next week is to test a lot of equipment to see what is most suitable for me. Which then in the long run is really good. So I kind of played a long game with that. I developed the relationships and everything already of the ones that I was kind of most likely to want to use. And then, you know, now I can sort of cement like some really good relationships for the next few years, which means I'm under less pressure to kind of go around organizing that stuff. But I wouldn't say, you know, people aren't going to bang down the door. I don't think the sport's not huge. So the thing that I found is, yeah, there's a lot more media attention as well. So, you know, you've got to be kind of
have strange men asking you to be on podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Watch your YouTube, so it's all good. But yeah, like there's that sort of thing. You need to have like answers prepared as well, because you get some curly questions that aren't appropriate and you need to know how to respond to those. So there's that media component of kind of improving your ability to respond and all those sort of things. So yeah, I guess it's been different, but I've always taken it quite like I've always been not taking it seriously, but I've always been well aware of all of that because I've been around people that have been involved at the higher levels and things. And so I've known, and you always get exposed to bits of it, but the constant exposure to a lot of that stuff is new. So being able to filter out that noise is going to be a big thing for me next year to kind of like still be able to focus on the bread and butter, which is the training. Yeah.
What's one of the inappropriate questions? I'm dying to know.
Do I have to timestamp it in our interview?
No, like it's a question around like someone like a Danny, can she be beaten? You know, like the stuff that's standard that people are going to ask you, and you need to have a response that is appropriate. Like, you know, and so you just got to be prepared for those kind of questions that maybe, like for example, before Hawaiian Ironman, that question was asked for the NBC broadcast, and yeah, it kind of, you know, I can respond to that. And that in for me, it's like, well, Danny's such a phenomenal athlete. We know her level. I'm aiming for that and above. I just need to do what I can do on the day. And, you know, if someone like a Danny's personality kind of like, or her history intimidates my competitors, it's a good thing for me. But yeah, they're the kind of, probably the questions that you need to be prepared for prior to all that stuff. Yeah.
I wonder if those questions, well, you could probably tell me, have those questions backed off a little bit after the fact, considering what happened with Jan? Because the same questions were being asked of all the men with Jan leading into it, saying, people were saying like, well, Jan, you know, it's kind of just a matter of, does he go under or over 8 hours? And then look at what happens. Like it's still sport. You don't know what's going to happen.
But it's also, sorry to interrupt, the standard tropes. Like it's those same questions, whether it's this group of athletes go 5 years back and that same question, can whoever be beat 5 years before that? Can whoever be, you know, it's like, I'm a former journalist, and that's a problem that I have with a lot of questions that get asked is people don't get creative or think before they ask. They just ask the standard cliche questions all the time, even though they don't mean anything. And how are you really going to answer it meaningfully anyway? Right? Like that's yeah, something that bothers me.
I want to know it's about like, pivot tables. That's a question.
Yeah. Yeah. See there. Now that's thinking.
But yeah, no, look, honestly, those questions were just really bait for Kona. It's to have a story. It's to find – you answer a response that is directly targeted at another athlete or at an outcome or at a situation or a scenario, and you're very detailed and you go into detail about it. You give them a story, and that's what they're looking for, and then that becomes more stress for you as you approach the race, because it will get asked again and they'll want for more and more. And that's why you need to kind of just be really prepared to have – you know, a reasonable response for you, and that it's enough to give people enough, but to move on. And, you know, I guess people can get caught up. Like there's been Rini versus this person in the run, or, you know, they're the story. They need to create something around an event. And so Taryn, to answer your question, I guess it's probably mostly it was really around Kona. The stuff since then has been more about, well, who really are you? We don't know much about me. And that's always easier to answer because it's just, you just talk about myself. Yeah.
I want to be respectful of your time. One last question that I've got is, so you touched on it earlier. You said that you still do a lot of speaking to the chartered accountant graduates for, I'm assuming, just Deloitte's class. Let's say you're speaking to a newly minted Sarah Crowley, CA, back in the day. What advice do you give to her now?
I think I actually won a Deloitte Businesswoman of the Year award, and that was actually one of the questions years ago. And it actually is more just to do what you're passionate about. Like if you, you know, I mean, they talk about it a lot in the workforce around if you're good at something and you're passionate about it, it's a sweet spot. But it truly is. Like if you can do something that you really – The day that, well, I mean, you can have bad days, but the day that you cumulatively over a period of time feel like it's a drag, then you're probably ready for another challenge. And so if you can find an area of, if it's working at Deloitte, if it's in an area that you're truly interested in and that you can go to work every day excited because you're going to learn something new, then money doesn't matter. And that's really important. And, you know, you'll get fulfillment in other ways. And, yeah, I think if you can, you know, detach money from what you're doing, I think that's like a really big step towards finding something you're passionate about and taking a little bit of risk to achieve happiness, I guess.
That's good. Yeah, good advice. I actually kind of had a similar chat with like young Taryn Gazelles at my old business school just last Friday. Yeah. And it's like, it's weird. Like it's something that we heard, or at least I heard 12 years ago when I was in school. I was like, yeah, I need to make money there, old man. And now now I'm the old man. And I'm like, don't worry about money. And I'm sure the kids are looking at me like, listen, who's the blonde guy that showed up in jeans? He probably doesn't have any money.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just this timeless advice that it takes a while to learn.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. If you hate it, it's like, it doesn't matter how much they pay you.
Yeah.
It's just going to eat you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. Where should people check you out and follow you? Number one, I'll do the plug in case you miss it. YouTube. You have a YouTube channel that has just magically blown up over the last week.
I know. And now you can just search Sarah Crowley Official and you get it. It's great.
Yeah.
So it actually has its own URL, which is amazing.
Why? How did that happen? That's amazing.
It's like internet magic.
Yeah. And then you know what? You stepped up too. I got messages that were just private message to me that after people went and subscribed to your YouTube channel, you put out the Island House vlog and people messaged and went, she's got some chops. Holy smokes. I'm like, yeah, I was impressed.
There's a snow. Just watch this space, people. There's a snow episode.
Nice.
What to do in the off season. And also, like, because I do some pretty interesting stuff. So I'll put on there some stuff around the velodrome testing that we're going to do. And they're just short videos, but it just shows what it looks like to do some of the things that I do. So, yeah, that's what I use that for. It's more, you know, I think people are kind of curious of the behind the scenes kind of look. So I try and just keep them short and just put them up so that people can appreciate kind of what it looks like to be a professional athlete, I guess. And yeah, and then, you know, people can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I don't have any funky names, so.
isn't Instagram a mixture of underscores and periods and things like that?
Oh, yeah, Sarah Stan Crowley, yes.
Oh, that's a tricky one. I'll link it up in the show notes, and people can find you through that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah. Appreciate you spending the time. Probably this is awesome meeting you.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
It's been a delight chatting and listening to your accent. Australian accent is my favorite. So thank you for that.
I get called exotic.
it's just lovely. I just love it. Thanks so much.
Hey, Trainiacs, I hope you dug that interview. Just a few things before you take off and get on to your next podcast. First off, if you want to get just the best Triathlon Terran stuff filtered for you every week, go to triathlonterran.com/thehits. Enter your email address, and every week, instead of having to sift through all the bad stuff to get to the good, we'll send you out a weekly email with our most popular YouTube video from the previous week, Instagram posts, spotting a podcast, or even some of the favorite gear that I'm trying out. Could be a book, could be some tech, whatever. If you enter your email address, we'll make it easy for you. Get to your best stuff every week by going to triathlonterran.com/thehits.
And next, if you want to support the show at all, you can go to triathlonterran.com and take your pick from a few things we've got there that you can work into your day-to-day training. We've got coaching plans if you are looking for one. We've got our awesome-looking Trainiac gear.
And if you click through the Amazon banner ad or click on any of the products that we mention or link to, and you purchase anything at one of the affiliate sites like Amazon, it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a small commission. And of course, everything adds up and helps us a lot to keep this thing going.
And finally, if you want to get a shout out personally for your family members, Tri Club, whatever you want, leave a rating for us over on iTunes, good, bad, whatever. And in the next podcast, we'll shout out everyone who in the previous week gave us an iTunes podcast rating. That really helps us get discovered there. And if you want to give a shout out to anyone specifically, share the podcast with someone and CC me in at Taren, T-A-R-E-N, at triathlonterren.com, and send us the message that you want to send to your loved one, friend, family member, most hated nemesis out on the tri course, whatever it is. Now it's time for shout outs.
Shout outs, everyone's favorite thing, shout outs.
You have been pushing for a song for shout outs this whole time.
No, I've been pushing for a song for the podcast, a jingle, if you will.
Well, work on a jingle and you might get it in there.
I just did.
Our first shout out goes to Tapper Gertube.
What?
People have the weirdest names reviewing us on iTunes.
Tapper McGee.
He or she, Tapper. Says, finally, a podcast from Canada. A. Got that A in there. We are now top of his podcast list. Very proud to say that some of our premium exports from Canada are maple syrup, hockey, curlers, me, moose, and now one Triathlon Taren and NTK podcast.
We export mice. We don't.
Mooses.
No. Anyway. All right, next shout out goes to Anarchist Brow. Yep.
I don't know where these names come from. I think they've got like a couple wheels of just messed up words, and then they spin them and they see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which ones
it's like
match
cards
up?
Cards Against Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Anarchist Brow, he or she says that we give he or she hope for the swim. So happy to provide some hope and help.
A little bit of happiness.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that happens with podcasting, but I think
maybe providing tips and help is what
tips and help.
Anarchist is going
for. You know what? I like to think that constant YouTube videos of me in a Speedo are probably more motivation.
That gives the world no hope. Actually.
Actually, a funny joke. Not bad. Next shout out goes to Athletica. Just one word. That's mm-hmm. all. Like share. The podcast, I want to say this is a her. I'm going to go out on a limb. I think it's a her. Athletica okay. is a her.
A gal.
Hopefully it's not a man sitting here hating me. Saying that we keep they motivated for the long miles on the trainer. Some little tidbit of advice that I can give you here. My life has been changed by Zwift. Hop on Zwift. I am I'm on there, biking around, looking good.
In my cartoon
my digital spandex.
Uh-huh. Okay, next one. Next shout out. Bill in Houston, Texas wants to give a shout out to his sister-in-law Jennifer as she recovers from plantar fasciitis, which really sucks. So sorry about that, Jennifer,
I'm kind of going through it right now.
Yep.
Foot pain sucks.
Yeah. You can foot pain solidarity with Jennifer.
Yeah, foot 5, Jay.
She what?
A foot 5, Jay. Jennifer.
Foot five.
It's like a high five,
but
with your feet.
See, now you're making up weird things.
Yeah, because I never do that in real life.
Yeah. Jennifer challenged old Bill to his first try in June, and they raced together in San Diego in September, which is very cool.
That's very sweet.
I like it.
I hope it didn't lead to her plantar fascia.
Yeah.
And finally, the last shout out of the day goes to Clint Winkler, who shared the John Joseph podcast with a friend. Clearly loves his expletives, Clint. That's a expletive-filled podcast.
And what did the friend say? Was the friend horrified? We need to get details from Clint here.
Clint, fill us in on if your friend was of age to listen to that podcast.
If your friend is still a friend.
If that friend is still a friend, because that John Joseph, he lets those curse words go.
Yeah.
Like he lets them out like he's handing out Tic Tacs.
I mean, your family loves curse words. Mm-hmm. The Gazelle clan is high on F-bombs.
We like them, yeah.
But that John made you guys
blush.
Put you to shame.
Yeah, tee-hee.
Tee-hee.
Thank you for all the shout outs.
Can I close with the jingle?
Why not? You made a really tasty dinner.
You said you liked the song. Here's the song. Shout outs, everyone's favorite thing, shout outs.
Great podcast, NTK.
Thanks.
Foot five.
No, I will not foot five you because that's not a thing.
Guys.